podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I first met Joe Sacco in Sarajevo in December 1995, when the fragile Dayton peace agreement had partitioned Bosnia into three antagonistic enclaves. The 3.5-year war, which had left 250,000 dead, had ended a few weeks earlier. But tension, revenge killings, and sporadic exchanges of fire still rippled ominously across the blighted landscape. We met on the outskirts of the bombed-out city of Sarajevo, where a French convoy was scheduled to leave for the safe area of Garajda at 5:30 in the morning. Joe, who had arrived early, lugging equipment and belongings, steamed as the 5:30 departure deadline slowly passed because the New York Times correspondent, who was me, had not yet appeared. Truth be told, I had finished my filing the night before around 11 p.m. and joined a group of reporters for one of those long drinking sessions that mark life in war zones. So when I did appear, breathless, disheveled, and smelling faintly of Bosnian whiskey, which I suggest none of you ever try and drink, Joe's impression of the imperial nature and arrogance of New York Times correspondents was only reconfirmed. But the trip along the snowy, icy roads through the deserted, pockmarked walls of abandoned Bosnian villages in the close confines of a Land Rover, a trip that I had thought would be one where I might get a little more sleep, turned almost instantly to the love Joe and I share for books. We spoke about Evelyn Waugh, Louis Fernand Céline, George Orwell, who it turned out we had each read exhaustively, and Boswell's Life of Johnson. It was in Garajda, where we did interviews together, that I instantly saw how remarkable, fiercely independent, talented, and brilliant Joe is. Quiet, soft-spoken, he is someone who radiates trust. More importantly, he has the finest quality in any reporter, and I believe any human being, and that is a deep capacity for empathy. He cared, and everyone around him knew it. And when good reporters are attacked for being too political or partisan or too involved in the story, it is often because they care, the cardinal sin of American journalism. Joe asked questions in interviews I should have thought to ask. He scribbled furiously in his notebook. He took pictures and made quick sketches. In the evening, he wrote out detailed accounts of the day's events in his journal. He had arrived in Bosnia, thinking he would do a book about Sarajevo, but quickly realized that the story of the war in Bosnia was better framed and understood in a much less well-publicized safe area, which is UN speak for a besieged city under continual bombardment and sniper fire from Serbs, an area called Garajda. And he was right. Garajda was largely inaccessible during the war. The siege was particularly brutal, the living conditions and suffering far harsher than anything the International Press Corps had witnessed in the Bosnian capital. It was also a story that no one had adequately told. In all the work we have done since, we did a piece from Gaza together for Harper's Magazine, one on Camden, New Jersey, per capita the poorest city in the country for the Nation, and we are currently doing a book together on the poorest pockets in the United States, including Camden, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, Pine Ridge in South Dakota, and among undocumented agricultural workers. These initial impressions have been repeatedly solidified. Typing out the tape transcripts of the interviews we are doing currently for this book is as humbling as sitting next to him that day in 1995 in Garajda. Joe probes and probes. He takes the interviews to a depth and level that I often have to kick myself for missing. What I admire most is that he invented his own genre. He refused to conform to what anyone else thought he should be doing or what anyone else had ever done. He took the form of the graphic novel and combined it with the highest levels of investigative journalism to create something new. And there is a word for this. It is called Genius. And I watched as he educated and pulled his readers over the years towards his unique and powerful art form. And it took a long time. He endured the bewilderment and even condescension from some of his own idols who could not and still not grasp what he does. He often made little money and at times suffered periods of serious financial deprivation. To this day, he has no health care, but he would not and he will never give up. He persisted, including the long and difficult 6 years it took him to finish Footnotes in Gaza, the story of the roots of Palestinian militant rage that began in 1956 when Israel, occupying Gaza, carried out wholesale massacres of unarmed Palestinian men and boys. And I was there for the genesis of that book as well. For in our article for Harper's on Gaza, we ran into elderly survivors of the 1956 massacre, a story little known outside of Gaza. And when I wrote their interviews into the article, the editors at Harper's, who had inexplicably made Joe redraw all of his illustrations so none portrayed the faces of Palestinians, cut the interviews because, as they said, it was ancient history. But if Harper's was not going to tell the story, Joe Sacco was. And by the time you put down Garajda or Palestine or his masterpiece, Footnotes in Gaza, which is one of the best books ever done on the Palestinians, and reduced me on a Thanksgiving morning to tears. You not only understand the lives he documents, but you feel because of his empathy, his tireless reporting, and his skill as an illustrator, their pain, their hope, their humanity, and the long night of their humiliation. Joe has the capacity to step into the shoes of others, to see the world from someone else's eyes. And you will see that in all the drawings in his books of himself, his own eyes are never visible from behind his round spectacles. He can be ruthless about the moral dilemma of his and our voyeurism into human suffering. He refuses to sentimentalize the poor, the occupied, the weak, like Celine. And this gives to his work the thunderous power of authenticity, as well as a pathos and a fierce honesty. He is not afraid of the ambiguities, nuances, and strange contradictions that make up human existence, that never make any tale a neat and easy one of good and evil. There are few writers or artists I admire as much as Joe Sacco. He has taken a prodigious talent and brilliance and used these attributes to give a voice to those who are often reviled, ignored, and who endure awful forms of violence and oppression. He does not compromise on his integrity. He does not compromise on the truth. He is, as I am, haunted by the suffering of the lives he has chronicled. These images of suffering come to him in his sleep or walking down a street or simply eating a meal. They are the ghosts that give to him finally that faint air of sadness, the burden of knowing what we are able in moments of extremity to do to each other. He defines the moral life, and you can't say that about many people. To honor him and his work tonight is to honor the best of ourselves, and I count it as one of the greatest blessings of my own life that he is my friend.
Well, that was a very kind introduction. Thank you. I mean, I'm sort of flabbergasted by that introduction. Chris will be writing the application for sainthood upon my death, I hope. But it was very sweet. I'd like to thank the people who brought me here at Lannan Foundation. I'm very glad to be here and to be with you. Thank you for coming out tonight. I hope when you leave tonight, you'll have a sense of my work and maybe a sense of how comics can be used as journalism. I kind of want to convince you of that. I mean, comics, you had them as a kid, and perhaps you've heard of graphic novels, and you may have read some, but this presentation is comics as journalism, and I'd like you to think of it as a medium that can also do journalism. So without further ado, I'll just start here. Okay, you probably all know this particular image. It was taken by a photographer named Eddie Adams, and he got the Pulitzer Prize for this image. It shows the chief of national police of the Republic of Vietnam executing a Viet Cong suspect on the streets of Saigon during the Tet Offensive in 1968. This is during the Vietnam War. And you probably also know that this is one of those photographs that galvanized the American public against the war. It just has this power to shock even to this day. Now, when you look at this picture, it also has a certain aesthetic value, if you don't mind me saying this. And if you forgive the pun, it's kind of the perfect shot. I mean, literally, it's at the instant of the Viet Cong suspect's death. And you can see that the image goes, if you take from the head of the general down his shoulder, across his arm to the gun, and then straight to the head of the Viet Cong suspect, you have this sort of curve that leads into it. And I think a photographer can wait probably his whole professional career for a picture like this. And a good photojournalist, through a combination of skill, the skill to basically insert yourself into a situation like this, and luck, literally to snap the image at the right time, it helped give Eddie Adams this particular image that we all know. Now, this is another image, a painting. It's by Goya. It's in the Prado Museum, and it's called The Third of May. And what it shows is Spanish civilians being executed by French soldiers. And the day before, the 2nd of May, subject of another of his paintings, the Spaniards rose up, or some group of Spaniards rose up in Madrid, and the insurrection was put down, and the next day they took out unarmed men, close to 200, and shot them down. And you can see, in some ways, you can call this also the perfect shot, because you can see the French soldiers on the right, and you don't get a sense of them as individuals. They just look like a war machine, and with their backs turned toward you, and you follow their guns to the victims. And really, the guns lead you, like the shot of that Eddie Adams took, to the victim. Again, the perfect shot. Now, what's the difference between these two pictures, besides, you know, the obvious fact that one's a painting and one's a photograph? I'd say it was one of intent, because Eddie Adams regretted the photograph he took, his well-known Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph. He thought it gave the viewer the wrong idea about what was going on, whereas you back home in 1968 would have thought, boy, look at this. This is going on in the streets of Saigon, a summary execution. The war is out of control. To him, he called the police general's cause just. And in an interview with Ollie North on Ollie North's television show some years back, he called the general a goddamn hero and got to know the general and personally apologized to the general that he had taken this image and that this image had basically followed the general around his entire life and hounded him. So Eddie Adams took this photograph, and he may have felt one thing about the situation, but the image had its own power, and it went out to people, and they interpreted it probably in a different way, it seems. With Goya, what you see is there's nothing accidental about a painting, or I would say about a drawing. Everything is deliberate. I mean, when you look at the painting, The Third of May, which is really one of my favorite works of art, you'll see it has a narrative structure. In the foreground, you see people who have been killed. In the middle, the guy with the white shirt there and his group, you see people who are about to get killed, and you see their faces. And then you see, just beyond that, there's a group of people being led up to be killed, and Madrid's in the background. And it's a perfect shot, and deliberately what Goya's done here is he has one of the victims in a white shirt, hands outstretched, looking straight at the guns. And Goya has deliberately chosen not to show them falling down as they're being shot, but the moment before, when they still have all their humanity remaining, they're not yet corpses. And as long as this image remains, that man and those people will be suspended there waiting for their deaths, and we will see their faces. Now, certainly not to compare myself to Goya, but to bring it to drawing again. This is an image from one of my comics about the Bosnian War, a short comic about a guy named Shoba. And Shoba was sort of this rock star guy in town, but had to do military duty. And at the beginning of the war, he was on a hillside in Sarajevo, and his unit was very heavily shelled by the Bosnian Serb nationalist forces. And he described to me, and it's the description is in the caption, how he actually had to hang onto the root of a tree to keep from being blown away. And he mentioned that people were flying end over end during this barrage. And what I've done is try to assemble different components to bring the reader into this particular place. I've got the men Shoba hanging onto a tree, his comrades sort of trying to bury themselves into the mud. There was a couple of shell bursts there, the swirling smoke, the shattered tree, the shrapnel that's hitting the tree, all these individual components. Probably very difficult to get, if you're a photographer, any two of those together at once, and probably very dangerous to do. But as an illustrator, as a cartoonist, you can sort of put yourself into an impossibly dangerous moment like that and assemble those elements. And again, the idea is to take the reader to that particular moment. This next shot is from, on this next page, is from a book I did called Palestine. And it shows a street clash in the town of Ramallah. In the first panel up top, you see Palestinian youths. They're collecting stones from the ground, or maybe breaking up some of the asphalt and picking it up. And the bottom two-thirds of the page shows the action. And I was watching this from across the street. The Israeli soldiers were sort of out of sight to me. And it was an impressionable moment for me. I think it was the first street clash I'd ever seen during the first Intifada. And these kids were hesitating and then running quickly, throwing stones, and then running back. And the action, what was taking place, was very quick. And I wanted the reader to get a sense of this quickness. So you'll see in the first of those small panels, you can see some of the background detail pretty clearly, like the car. In the others, most of the background detail is lost in the swirl of the movement, so those movement lines. And you'll see, to sort of enhance the tension of the moment, the panels are at these sort of odd angles. And you'll see, even coming down the page, I have the captions are broken up. And they're also at odd angles to sort of emphasize the tension. And they are like specifically cut at certain points to develop a certain rhythm. In other words, you're not reading a whole box of text. The text is cut up into these little elements. So you read automatic fire, soldiers, the kids are running, hurling stones over the bus, rat-tat-tat-tat. I mean, I'm literally, with this kind of rhythmic way I'm cutting up the caption here, I'm trying to sort of mimic the sound of automatic fire with these sort of clipped captions. Actually, this is something I learned from Ferdinand Céline, because I liked his clipped language, where he would have these short phrases separated by ellipses. To me, it was very effective. It was like this drumming sound I had in my head when I was reading his work, and I wanted to sort of capture some of that with this particular image. Again, for a purpose, to sort of put the reader into that moment. And now, not all moments are these sort of moments of strife or these action scenes. A lot of images I do are just relatively benign drawings of places where there'd been a lot of violence. And Chris was talking about the safe area Garajda, and I did a book, as he mentioned, about this town, which was under siege, very heavily shelled. There was a lot of deprivation in this town. At certain points, the people of the town were in near starvation conditions. And again, what I'm trying to do is take you, the reader, and put you on that street. And here again, I've assembled these elements that are informational, journalistically speaking, to give you a sense of what it was like to be there. And you see people there chopping wood in the lower left-hand corner. And there was a lot of that going on because the Bosnian Serbs had captured the town of Visegrad, where there was a hydroelectric plant. And so there was no electricity in the town. And people were using wood to for heat and to cook. And then you see like a guy on the far right who's with a wheelbarrow carrying water and wood. And in Garajda, which was at that time a town of about 60,000 people, when you had the influx of refugees from around the town, there were only about 8 running vehicles. All had been taken by the army, and they were just used for army purposes because obviously there wasn't much gasoline in the town. And then what I particularly want to draw your attention to are the buildings in the background with the shell marks on them. A scene I repeat over and over again in the background in the book, because as I said, it was very heavily shelled. And you see where the shells have ripped into the walls, where some rooms have been burned out, and there's plastic sheeting on the roofs where perhaps a mortar shell or some shrapnel had opened up the roof, and obviously people want to keep out the rain. So now I'd read about Garajda. It was actually in the New York Times by a correspondent named John Burns, who had managed to get through the blockade with a couple of other reporters. And he wrote some great articles about Garajda that really made me sort of pay attention. I'd never heard of this place until his articles. But what I never got from his articles was a sense of what the place looked like. And I remember the first time I went to Garajda, it was on a UN convoy. The UN was allowed to run convoys into Garajda because basically NATO had bombed the Bosnian Serbs, and now the Serbs had agreed to allow uninterrupted access to Garajda. So I got there, but I wasn't sure what it would look like. In my own mind, I had really pictured this small village, spread out village of farmland, and what it was. Besides that, were a lot of apartment buildings, and what I'm not showing you here, a lot of multi-story apartment buildings, quite large. And that was a surprise to me. And what's interesting about prose, I think the power of prose is it allows a reader to fill in images. And then I think sometimes the problem with prose is it allows a reader to fill in images, because sometimes you can fill in no image or the wrong image. So this is what I'm trying to give to the reader, is that the image. So what a place actually looks like. Okay, now what's the next one? The next one is Sarajevo, a few months before I first got to Garajda. And I went to Garajda over Mount Igman in a French armored personnel carrier, and then I transferred to a civilian bus. And to be honest, I didn't know where I was going to stay when I got to Sarajevo, and I heard journalists went to the Holiday Inn. So I thought, okay, I'll go to the Holiday Inn. Of course, I found out it was like $180 a night. And after about 10 nights, I'd be out of money. So I had to quickly... I spent one night there and had to get out of there. But I told the bus driver, you know, stop me near the Holiday Inn. And then some people pointed me down this slope. And I knew the Holiday Inn was right along what was called Sniper Alley. And I knew the front line was very close to the Holiday Inn. And I sort of figured these people weren't going to point me in a dangerous way to get to the Holiday Inn. So if I just walked straight toward it, I'd probably be okay. But as Chris can tell you, if you're in a situation like this, in a conflict zone, the worst feeling you can have is when it's just an open, barren area and it's silent. And I remember when I was trying to write this particular scene up, I wrote about that silence. I was trying to describe what it's like. And then, you know, when you're drawing, you realize that's the last thing I should do now is impose words upon this picture, because you want the reader to feel what I felt. You want the reader to feel what I felt and not have the barrier of words to get in the way, even if those words would accurately describe that feeling. So that's what I'm trying to do with an image like this, because sometimes you can be more effective when you leave out words. Now, another place, I wanted to take the reader into in my books about the Bosnian War was a place called Club Obala in Sarajevo. And it might be one of those places that the West, you know, Western people love to think about. It was a place where there were young people, smart young people, Croats, Serbs, Muslims. It wasn't a question of them celebrating their ethnic identities or, you know, celebrating each other's ethnic identities. In fact, in a place like this, they didn't care what your ethnic identity was. They were just Sarajevan young people. And it sort of lived up to that Sarajevan ideal that we all like to think about. It was one of the most interesting places I've ever been in because it was a place where the present really mattered. And it really mattered deeply. And young soldiers would get off their duty, which was about just a few hundred meters away because the front line ran through the urban part of Sarajevo. So they'd get out of their positions and they'd go to the Club Obala to meet their girlfriends. And they had the most current music because these people were connected enough that they knew foreign journalists, foreign aid workers, and they would ask them to bring CDs from abroad. So they had everything you could want in a rock club. And they just were very passionate about everything. And you can see there are people playing air guitar there, and there are people headbanging. And now the other drawings I've shown you, and many I will show you presently, are very representational. I try to draw, even though I was never really trained to do it, as realistically as I can. In a case like the stuff on the left-hand side of the page there, you can see there are very cartoony elements because comics is a very fluid medium. You can go from representation to its cartoony attributes, I think with sort of a fluid ease. And the reason I want it to be cartoony is there was no other way to capture the intensity of the place by drawing representationally. I needed those swoosh marks. I'll show you another picture here of these guys headbanging. I needed that. You know, I wanted... Now, those features are exaggerated, their teeth showing, you know, their faces, and the swoosh marks. But really what's not exaggerated is the intensity. So in some ways, I'm drawing unrealistically to get to a realistic place that might be otherwise hard to capture, which is something I think you can do with cartoons and with comics. Now, I've shown you a lot of sort of bigger splash pages, but, you know, the meat and potatoes of comics is multi-panel pages. So here there are 9 panels, and this is another place and a time. This is Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, and it's from my book Palestine in the early 90s. And I made a friend in Jabalia, and we were walking somewhere. And, you know, none of these pictures individually are masterpieces by any stretch of the imagination. But in comics, really what you're trying to do is, generally speaking, you're trying to use a lot of images to build up to a whole. And the whole I'm trying to get to is the atmosphere of the place. I want the reader to feel like they're walking with us. And the interesting thing about the time I was there was there was a lot of rain, and people were flooded out of their homes. I don't think they'd seen that kind of rain in many years. And, you know, the weather was very bad, and there was mud and puddles everywhere. And if you notice, each image here, and in the ones I'll show you coming up, which continues the story, there's the weather is, you see the clouds, the dark clouds, and the mud. And the thing is, no matter what's going on as far as the caption goes, whatever the foreground story is, the background has these consistent images of mud, for example. Now, I was thinking, how could a prose writer do this? A prose writer can very well, I think, describe conditions like I'm describing to you now. But what a prose writer really can't do, or can't do without it sounding quite awkward, I think, is after every sentence say, "and it was very muddy," "and it was very muddy," "and it was very muddy." I mean, that wouldn't go over too well. But in comics, you can basically do that by repeating the imagery. So the mud follows the reader around and seeps into the subconscious of the reader, I think, just like it basically seeped into our shoes as we were walking in Jabalia. The other thing I think that comics can do with sort of a fluid ease is take a reader into the past. Now, this is from my book, the newest book, Footnotes in Gaza. And this is Rafah Refugee Camp, where I spent a couple of months to do the book. And on the left, you see it as I saw it in 2003. And on the right, you see it as it was in the mid-1950s, which is the time period of most of the subject matter of the book, as Chris was mentioning to you. And in the book, these images appear next to each other, and it's basically the exact same shot separated by about 50 years. So what you have on the right are these houses that have been built up and into the and people have built up and into the street over the course of many years, because a lot of these refugee camps are very contained, in this case by the Egyptian border and by the town of Rafah. So people often have no option but to build up and into the street. And that shows you the change. And I think this is something comics can do. Like, you can put this side by side and give you that feeling. But how do I take a reader into the past? How do I go about doing something like that? Well, in Gaza City, I went to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, headquarters, and they have a really good photo archive there. And the good people at UNRWA, and UNRWA takes care of Palestinian refugees in the Middle East, they gave me copies of every photograph they had of refugee camps in Gaza over the decades. So what you see here, these two pictures on the left, one that photo on the top is Rafah in 1971. And you can see not much had really changed from the 50s to 1971. You know, if you look at my illustration, maybe there was more, you know, people had put gardens in their sort of courtyards, but that's almost basically it. The bottom picture is Han Yunus refugee camp, which is very nearby. And that was taken in the mid-50s, the period I was looking at, and that gave me a sense of what the barren conditions where these camps were built. So between these two pictures and many others that I was able to collect, I feel I can, you know, draw something like that on, like that illustration you see on the right, and feel like, okay, that's, I feel comfortable that's a good representation of what the camp looked like in those days. Now, Chris mentioned to you something about the subject matter of this book. It takes place during the Suez Crisis. And among other things, in the Suez Crisis, the Israeli army captured Gaza, which at that point was administered by the Egyptians. And Israel occupied Gaza for about 4 or 5 months until, believe it or not, the U.S. administration under Eisenhower basically gave the Israelis an ultimatum to leave Gaza and also the Sinai Peninsula, which they'd captured. So they left. But in that four-month period, the Israelis decided that what they were going to do is capture Palestinian soldiers who had served in the Egyptian army, who had obviously, after the defeat of the Egyptian army, slipped back into civilian clothing. And they were going to find guerrillas, Palestinian guerrillas. Just before this period, there was a vicious border war going on. The Palestinian guerrillas were basically run by Egyptian intelligence and were attacking Israeli civilians and military targets in Israel. And Israel was attacking military and civilian targets in Gaza. So this was Israel's opportunity to capture the soldiers and the guerrillas. So what they did on November 12, 1956, was they, over loudspeaker, they called all men in Rafah of military age, which basically means ages 15, 16 to about 60, 65, to go to a number of places, but in particular, a government school in the center of town. And the men ran to the school. They were harassed along the way. Some of them were shot along the way. They were beaten at the gates of the school. And according to the UN, 111 Palestinians were killed on that day. So that's what the book's about. And here I show them running. And here I show a man I spoke to who described to me going through this school gate. And so what I've done is I've basically drawn him from a photograph I took. And now you can argue with my artistic ability, but that's basically what the guy looked like. The quote is an accurate quote. It's taken from a transcription from a taped interview. And so far, so good. I mean, I've done nothing really different from what a prose journalist or any journalist is doing or should do, and that's get an accurate quote and present it in an accurate fashion. But beyond that, what I'm doing is I'm placing that quote on an image that reflects what the man is describing. So here we see the Palestinians huddled on the left, forced by Israeli soldiers, and now some of them are beginning to run through the school. Now, obviously, I didn't speak to just this man. I spoke to a few dozen men who were there on that day, and they all basically described the same thing. So I felt justified in how I placed things. The school wall, now there are shops along the school wall. At that time, it was described to me as something about just over head height. The Israeli soldiers, I mean, I looked at photographs to get their uniforms, weapons right. So I'm trying to do it right, but I cannot deny that there is an underlying tension between an accurate quote and a drawing. I mean, ultimately, a drawing is an interpretation. And ultimately, the artist, in this case, we're talking about me here, I mean, I'm interpreting, I'm a filter. So there is a tension. I mean, how do I know what it looked like? Again, I'm asking questions. I'm asking a lot of visual questions that often a prose writer certainly has no need to ask, but to put myself in that position. The fact that it's an interpretation doesn't let me off the hook. As much as possible, my interpretation, I feel, has to be an informed interpretation. That's why I'm trying to gather as much information about this particular scene or other scenes as possible. And just to take the story over a few pages here, the men, the Palestinian men, were, as you can see on the left there, they were huddled together in a large group, and Israeli soldiers surrounded them and were also on the roof of the school. That's the school building there. And the Israelis, they didn't finish the screening process. I mean, we're talking about thousands of men that they tried to screen in one day, and they simply couldn't finish it. But at the beginning, they were trying to get groups of Palestinians in manageable groups. They opened up the barbed wire, and they took them past the jeep. And in the jeep, as was described to me, was a man who was hooded, had a blanket over his head, something like that. And he would signal, apparently he was a spy or a collaborator, he would signal every, perhaps by honking the horn of the jeep or just making a note to an Israeli officer sitting next to him, every time someone came by who was in the military and was in civilian clothes now. So the Israelis knew to take that guy and take him to prison in Israel. If the individual passed that particular test, he was taken to a group of tables, which you can sort of see back there just above the jeep, where there were Israeli officers who were interrogating, very, very quick interrogations, and if need be, taking them to some back rooms to be interrogated. By the end of the afternoon, the questions were very quick. It was like, where do you work? And the officer would basically size up the person almost visually to decide if this person was a soldier or not. So this scene was described to me. So now how do I take the reader into this particular place and feel like I'm actually describing it relatively accurately? Well, what I did is I drew a map of the school from above, very simple map. That C-shaped building is that C-shaped area there. That's the school. You see the walls around it. And what I did is if a witness was particularly lucid and had a strong memory, and, you know, working with 50-year-old memories gets very problematic, especially when you're talking about a long period of time spent in a schoolyard in fear. But these men seem to have a good grasp on that day and their memories. And they would draw for me, or they would direct me in how to draw things like, where were the tables with the Israeli soldiers? Where was the jeep placed? Where was the barbed wire? What was the movement of the people? It's not as if they each gave me the exact same ideas. Even though they had strong memories, they may have had strong different memories. But they gave me enough to go on, enough to feel like, okay, it's definitely barbed wire was on this side. The Jeep, in all likelihood, was in this position here. So I was going on that sort of thing. And fortunately, the building, the school building, still stands. It's still a school building. It's still an operating school building. It was built by the British in the 30s. And I took many pictures of the building. Unfortunately, I don't have one here to show you of the facade of the building. But this is from one of the sort of open-air passageways. And it's taken from inside the school out. So I had pictures like this. And then in the bottom photograph, you can see a man with a white cap. He was one of the people, one of the Palestinians who was there that day. And we walked over the ground with him. There's my colleague Abed in the black outfit down below there too. We walked there, and this older gentleman pointed out where he was, and he would give me the information I needed. Like, see this wall behind me now? That didn't exist in those days. This was all an open area. So with information like this, like walking the grounds with someone who was there, with the photographs, with the maps, I feel like I could put something together that I felt was a reasonable facsimile of what happened. I mean, in some ways you can think of what I'm doing as a film director trying to organize a scene, a set. Now, the book, besides being about the incidents that took place in Han Yunus and in Rafah in the 50s, takes place at the moment I'm there. And I always like to write about the process of getting a story and what is going on at the time. And what was going on while I was in Rafah were a lot of home demolitions by the Israeli army. So let me just sort of give you an idea of the scene here. The top area, that top residential area there, that's Egyptian Rafah. The area on the right, the built-up area on the right, that's Palestinian Rafah. The border, for some reason, the Israelis and the Egyptians, when they made peace in the mid-70s, they ran the border right through the town of Rafah, and they bulldozed a lot of homes to run the border there. After that period, the Palestinians in the refugee camp, as I mentioned, you know, they need to build somewhere. They began to rebuild in that area. And that entire open area you see there on the right, that was all homes that had been demolished just before I'd gotten there. And at that time, about 850 homes had been demolished, basically just turned to sand. And what you saw there was just chunks of concrete where there were just bare remnants of homes. And then you'll see the Egyptian border is that far fence. Then that closer barrier, that sort of blast wall barrier, that was put there by the Israeli army. Because at the time, the Israeli army was, under the Oslo Accords, had access to a passageway called the Philadelphia Route. And from that route between the border and that barricade area, their vehicles would go up and down. They could go from one military post to another. Then they would make incursions into the town by basically going through that barrier and doing their incursions. And the reason they gave for destroying homes was there were tunnels. And there were tunnels like there are today in Gaza, which is now under a very severe blockade. There were tunnels running from Palestinian Gaza to Egyptian Gaza, and a lot of goods were coming in. And of course, the Israelis were particularly worried about weapons coming in and bullets, and also claimed that terrorists were coming in. So the Israeli position was they would destroy any home from where a tunnel was leading, where there was a tunnel pier. And they would destroy any home from where they'd received gunfire from Palestinian fighters. And they would destroy any abandoned home. That was their position. So you can see they destroyed a lot of homes. And I want to give the reader a sense of the scale of what was going on. Now, obviously, I wasn't about to ask the Egyptian military or the Israeli military, you know, can you please fly me over in a Piper Cub so I can take photographs? But you know, using cartooning magic, you can just sort of lift yourself up into a, so your virtual crane or helicopter, and you can get an image of this. Just knowing a few things about drafting, you can sort of carry the reader up so you can see this from the air. So, because I want the scale, the magnitude of this destruction to be clear to the reader. Anyway, we began running toward the scene of what we heard was a bulldozing, and you'll see on the horizon there's a little dust coming up on the right where a bulldozing was going on, and we ran over this sandy area because we didn't want to fiddle with all the winding pass alleyways of the refugee camp to get there quicker. And I'm going to show you some of this story, and then I'll go over it again and show you how I got my images. There's a page I skipped where we're just running. We get to a man, and he told us, he was with his mother. He mentioned a bulldozer or Israeli vehicle has smashed into the back of my home. And, you know, naturally being the voyeur journalist that I am, it's like, can I see it? And he put his eye up to a bullet hole in the gate, and he said, there's a tank inside. So naturally we left him, and we ran around some buildings, and we came to the place at the bottom of the page here where there were a lot of Palestinian kids who seem always to be drawn to incidents like this, and Palestinian journalists. So we were gathered with them, and we were watching a bulldozer and this drilling machine. And this machine was drilling into the ground, this Israeli drilling machine, and then it was placing explosives. And there'd be a sudden, sharp explosion, which would scatter the kids, as you see in the front, the top panel. Basically, they were trying to collapse tunnels. Then this bulldozer, which was doing its bulldozer thing, suddenly veered over and crashed into the back of the house we were watching. And the kids now are used to the scene, so they climbed onto the ridge and began showing off for each other in open view of the Israelis, at which point an Israeli vehicle came right at us. And it came at us very quickly, and naturally we all started to run, except, of course, a photojournalist, often the craziest people in a situation like this, who just, you know, is going to stand his ground and get his images. Now, what I wanted to give to the reader here is a sense of the simultaneity of the things going on. So you have the Israeli armored fighting vehicle coming toward us, and you can see the images of it coming straight down the page. Then you have the kids running from the right, which is sort of counterintuitive in the West, but from the right of the page down to the bottom, and then you see the photographer lifting up his camera with a few images. Then there was a kid. You see him sort of in the middle there. He was stuck on the ridge. He wasn't quick enough, and he decided just to wait it out on the ridge. I didn't bother to find out, you know, what was going to happen to him, so I ran too. We ran around some buildings. I'm leaving out a page or two now. We came to a woman who saw my foreign face, rightly assumed I was a journalist of some sort, and just started a speech about what was going on. And a photographer, quickly seeing her getting hysterical, quickly just turned on her, got about 10 seconds worth of shots of her, and then turned away and just walked away from her. And then walked over to take some pictures. There you see him in the middle. There's a cameraman and another photographer. And then a guy showed up, dressed quite well, and he just started yelling at this camera crew and the photographers. And because they were taking images and pictures of two Palestinian fighters across a field who were near his home. You can see those fighters in the bottom picture on the left there. And as I told you, the Israelis said they would destroy any home from where they were receiving gunfire. So if he saw an image of his home with Palestinian gunmen there in the newspaper or on television, he felt, well, the Israelis can see this too. They'll figure out it's my home and they'll demolish it. So he wanted no part of this journalistic thing going on. So he yelled at them, and then he strode across a field to give a piece of his mind to the gunmen. And he started yelling at them, just telling them to get away, you know, leave this area. I don't want you anywhere near my home. Now, a lot is going on in these sort of situations. It's almost comical on a certain level. suddenly some activists showed up, the International Solidarity Movement activists. These are activists from Europe and North America, and they were staying in homes that seemed of great risk of being demolished. And here they were unfurling a banner saying, "Stop the demolitions." And at the bottom picture, I'm trying to give the reader, now I've had a lot of these sort of close shots, I'm trying to give a reader again the sense of what the whole area looks like. So perhaps you can't see it in this detail here, but I have the photographers still behind a wall. I show the Palestinian gunmen, fighters, sort of moving up along a house. You can see the people with the banner there. In the distance, you can see the Israeli vehicles, a bulldozer, the driller, and the armored fighting vehicle. And then beyond that, you can see the Philadelphia route with that barricade. And beyond that, you can see some houses, a mosque, and a watchtower. That's all Egypt. So again, I'm trying to give the reader that sense. So now, I'll just go over this relatively quickly, the same group of pages, and I'll show you how I tried to put this together, how I was able, I feel, to do it, and you know, give it its due. That barricade, the Philadelphia route, that was easy to get photographs of. I had many photographs of those blast walls and of the Egyptian landscape in the distance. That group of homes in the bottom left that you see, badly damaged homes, I took many pictures of that particular group of homes, and that is that particular group of homes as best as I could render them. Then on the right, the skyline of Palestinian Rafah, I had a friend who was living right on the edge there, worried, of course, about his home getting demolished, and his home was demolished eventually. But at that time, it was a 3 or 4 story structure, and from his balconies, I was able to take some good pictures along that skyline. The man with his mother, you know, immediately I knew this is going to be an interesting scene in my book, so I knew enough to take pictures of him then and there. And you'll see I'm even trying to show his clothes as they are, and the gate, the pattern on the gate. Then you'll see that building in the illustration, a partly collapsed building from a previous bulldozing. I went to the same area some days later, over the course of a number of days, really, and took photographs from different angles, so I knew I would be able to recreate a lot of these scenes later on. Now, with the picture of the bulldozer, I've never operated with a very good camera. I'm not a good photographer. And if I showed you slides, well, you're seeing some of my pictures. They're very dull. But I knew a photojournalist who worked with AP, and he had many good, crisp images of the Caterpillar bulldozer that the Israelis use. There's several varieties they use. And here's one of the ones I used for reference that he had given to me. Now, you'll see I have an image of the damage of the building. And now if you compare with the illustration, you see I'm not overdoing it or underdoing it. That's pretty much as it was because I was able to get that particular photograph. And what's interesting is that we visited this home, you know, in the next couple of days or so, and my guide, Abed, happened to know, it was a total coincidence, was friends with one of the guys who lived in this house, one of the sons in the family. And Ashraf, the guy who lived in the house, became one of the figures I followed through the book. And I told you that the Israelis were demolishing homes that were abandoned. Well, they were living in the home until it was hit by the bulldozer. At that point, they abandoned it. Now the Israelis can say, well, that's an abandoned home, so it can be demolished. But there were other ways. I mean, gunshot marks in the walls, because just with the spraying of the area, just with if it's crossfire, whatever it is, there's other ways of sort of signaling to people that it's time for them to move out of their homes. That's what happened to him. So now the image of the Israeli vehicle, again, my friend, AP photographer, had great images of that one. This was actually taken at the memorial service for Rachel Corrie, who was killed while I was in Rafah. And there was a memorial service
put on by the activists, which Palestinians actually joined, in this very dangerous, sandy, no-man's land I'd shown you in some of the pictures. It was perhaps the one time Palestinians felt safe enough, because there were so many foreigners, to drift out into this area. And there was Israeli vehicles moving around us, eventually firing tear gas to disperse us. But anyway, he got this image there. Now, the woman I mentioned, I sort of calmed her down. I took out my pad. I interviewed her a little bit. And then I asked her for a photograph. And that's it on the left. The guy who was telling off everyone, he was very angry. And there's a scene in the book where I try to approach him to talk to him. And he would have nothing to do with me either, because as far as he's concerned, I'm just one of them, really. And, you know, frankly, I was. So I didn't get a picture of him. But in my journal that night, I drew what I remembered of his face, you know, in a very, very quick, rough manner, basically the shape of his face and some details like the mustache, maybe the fact that he had short hair and the way it was and how he was relatively well-dressed. That's the best I could do in a situation like that. Sometimes it's not perfect. And then this last image, again, I took photographs at the scene. You can see the International Solidarity Movement people with their banner. And if you see that building there, that's the one, that photograph of the building, if you go down below to the illustration, that's that same building. And same with the one on the right, it's one of the buildings just below it. I also, in my journal, you know, in describing this scene at great length, I drew these little maps, which I've blown up here, to show how we ran around which building, to help myself remember how this whole scene developed. So there are two little maps that showed where the field was, where there was a little mosque, how we ran across the road, where the fighters were, where the photographers were. Those things aided me in putting this image together later, plus, of course, the photographs. So, again, this is an interpretation. You're seeing something I saw through my eyes and through my hand, with all the limitations that I have. But I think if someone was from Block J in Rafah refugee camp, which is this particular area, I would hope that they could point to a house and say, oh, yes, so-and-so used to live there. And that's where that little mosque was. So that's the level I try to get to whenever I can. And that gives you a rough idea of what I'm doing and how comics and journalism work. So that's the end of the presentation.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
So I thought I'd begin, since Joe and I have both worked overseas, and you've even done comics, Christmas with Karadzic, about the press. And because the way that you chose to report these stories is so unique and at variance with many of the sort of traditional methods of covering a conflict, how it was for you when you first bumped up against the International Press Corps, what you began to observe, what bothered you about it, you know, what your observations were, and what sort of set you on a different path?
Well, in a way, the path was sort of made for me because I never went to these places, at the beginning anyway, with anything but my own money. So when you're there on your own dime, you can't really hang out with the press corps. So really, for the first 2 months I was in Bosnia, I avoided them completely. Partly also, I have to admit, I was worried what they would think. You know, a cartoonist in Bosnia, what the hell are you doing here? What's good about that is it forced me to sort of rent a room from an older woman and stay with her. And from her, I got a different sense. I mean, you get a different sense when you're living in a place like that as opposed to in a hotel. And when you're not hanging out with journalists, you still want a social life. And having little money, I was doing what Bosnian people were doing. That's how I sort of found Club Obala, and they welcomed me there. And the interesting thing is, as you know, a lot of people in Sarajevo were very cynical about the press, And when I got there, they said, oh, you're okay, you're a cartoonist. To them, that was sort of a cultural cachet, which I was able to sort of use. Now, the press themselves, when I finally did meet them, I have to say, mostly they were very gracious to me. I felt that if you could talk in that sort of rarefied air about what was going on, you knew what was going on, you were accepted. I did see, you know, I hang out with a lot of radio journalists, and what I did see is sort of this mixture of concern for the place coupled with how much money they were going to be making. And I paid a lot of attention to how much money each, they would say, well, if you tell, one journalist would tell another, you know, you just gave that story, and that's five stories. You could have broken that up into five stories and made five times the amount of money. There was this constant talking about money. I guess it, you know, maybe out of necessity, but that was going on at the time, too.
That's the bifurcation, though, between freelance reporters and staff correspondents, which wasn't true if you were there for the Washington Post or the New York Times. But I think you captured that. And there was a kind of mercenary quality to it. I mean, I didn't. If you're there as the New York Times correspondent, your salary is not in any way dependent upon what you file. But a lot of the journalists you chronicled essentially were, and Christmas with Carriage is the perfect sort of little comic of that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, what you did there.
Well, in Christmas with Carriage, I was with two radio stringers. And we decided one day we were going to find Radovan Karadzic, who was an indicted war criminal. And at the time, now he's in The Hague. They actually got him and put him in The Hague. But at the time, he was still walking around freely. And it was clear that he wasn't going to be captured, probably for political reasons, because, you know, with the war ending, you didn't want a scuffle over political leaders. So he was allowed to sort of fade into the background. But we basically went looking for him one day. It was Christmas, and we found him in a church in Pale. And the journalists, you know, they were looking for actualities. I mean, the radio is an interesting thing because they always need sound. And so you go to a place, you hear gunfire, and you head there so they can get the sound of the guns for their stories. And as soon as you get there, the sound... there is no sound. There is no gunfire. And they're basically swearing up, saying, will you goddamn start firing a machine gun out the window? it was amusing in this kind of way, you know. We found Karadzic, and one of the journalists did a quick interview with him that he probably turned into. I think he had he called it a $1,000 day, because he was able to file it a number of times for different outlets. And then we went into mass with him. And it was odd for me because this is someone I actually had despised from a distance for so long. And then I'm sure you've felt this with a lot of people. You've met so many of these sorts of people. You're up with them, and it's sort of like Hannah Arendt, is her comment, the banality of evil. I couldn't bring myself to hate the guy somehow. I could hate him as an abstraction. In flesh, it was very difficult to sort of rise to that hatred. It was an odd feeling.
Yeah. A lot of your earlier work is satirical,
yeah.
Or was satirical, something which I think you want to go back to.
I'd like to. I mean, I got it in it for the laughs, basically, and it's funny where I ended up.
it's very pointed satire. I mean, it has a kind of saline, there's a political edge to it. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that comic you did on the Trotsky, on the...
Oh, this was called Mark Victory Stooge. And it was actually based on a friend of mine who was at the time one of the only paid members of the Trotskyist party in the United States. I think there were about two or three paid members. And he was like sent to become a sheet worker in Detroit to agitate. And I mean, to his credit, he's still very active in getting union movements going. I mean, this guy is committed. And I did a comic about him because he's kind of one of those guys who just can't get a date. So in the comic, he has a date. He's in a thespian, a Marxist thespian play where he's playing the hammer and she's playing the sickle. And and so they meet and, you know, they're doing a theatrical version of Wages, Prices, and Profits, one of Marx's books. But I've always really enjoyed. You know, I guess if you had to nail me down politically, I come from the left, and I think Marx had a lot. He had what capitalism is, you know, down. His prescription might be all wrong, but he was very good at analyzing what was going on, I think. But you know, I want to have a bit of fun with it. Some of them were for fun in a way like that, but others were very pointed. I worked in offices. When you're in an office community, you felt it's very odd. They're sort of stringing you along with ideas about promotion. I was actually told by someone, "Oh, you know, they're dangling that carrot in front of you. You should make sure you stay on it." And that sort of language was so repugnant to me and so rife for satire. You know, in the end, I just had to get out of that world and do something interesting.
Let's talk a little bit about footnotes in Gaza, because it's not only a tour de force. I know it took so much out of you.
Yeah.
I think I remember you saying to me at one point that you probably couldn't even do a work like that again. But talk a little bit about the process, what it meant, and not only in terms of physical terms of what you had to do, but the emotional cost of doing it.
Well, drawing's a funny thing in a way, because, you know, I wanted to tell this story right. I wanted to tell it from the moment, for example, with Rafa, where the people are called by loudspeakers to run to the school, to the moment when many of them are bodies, and their bodies abandoned in the street. But that's not where the story ends. I mean, someone has to deal with the bodies. The family has to deal with the bodies. Generally speaking, in a situation like that, the women, they're the only ones who feel they're not going to get shot, perhaps, if they go and deal with the bodies. So I wanted to go through this whole process. And the thing about drawing, I don't know how photographers feel, and I can't even tell you, I'm sure you have a lot of scarring from what you've seen in particular and what you've written about, but when you're drawing, you have to inhabit everyone. You have to sort of, you know, I've never really studied art, so I constantly have to look in the mirror, and I have to do these actions. For example, if an Israeli soldier is raising a club, I have to look in the mirror and think, oh, the right shoulder goes up, the left shoulder goes down, the arm naturally comes forward, the hips twist in this way, the uniform twists in a certain way. So you're inhabiting that person. You're inhabiting the person who's got his arm up to shield the blow. So you're sort of inhabiting everything. And you have to just be in a place that, to be honest, you're not in when you're actually doing the interviews. I think, and you tell me what you think, but when I'm talking to someone, I'm in a very professional, sort of, it's a very professional, cold level.
Clinical.
It has to be clinical. You have to get the information. You're constantly steering someone who's often can be close to tears. You've got to be careful with the person, but you're also trying to direct them somehow. I mean, journalism is about funneling someone down the trough you want them to go down to get the information you need. So you're being so clinical about it. You're going from interview to interview, and you're just putting it over your shoulder. Now, I don't know. What about you?
Yeah, it always hit you at night. It always hit you when you got back and you were alone in your room.
And what about when you're writing about this stuff?
Yeah, I had stories where, you know, they were almost impossible to write.
And the thing is, there just came a point when I just didn't want to face the drawing table. And I like to draw. I mean, it's a good life to be able to draw for a living. So to not really want to go into my drawing room was really telling me something. And it went on for months. And the last part of the book, especially, probably took, you know, 18 months of solid drawing, very hard stuff. And by the end of it, I thought, I don't know if I really want to draw this sort of thing again.
What is it that drew you to that story, which ended up consuming 6 years of your life? Why that incident?
It's exactly what you described. You know, we went together to Gaza, and Chris was going to do the writing. And to me, you know, it was kind of a privilege to be with Chris because he's a very seasoned journalist. Just to see, it's interesting to be with another journalist and let that journalist lead the conversations, because you see how another journalist is asking questions, and you think, oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. So, it was good to go with him and let him, you did most of the interviewing, and all I was really doing were the illustrations. So to me, a lot of pressure was off me. But the fact that Harper's, for whatever reason, decided, perhaps it was space, decided that that was the scene, the story about Han Yunus was going to be left out, what happened historically. To us, it was a very important part of the story. And then there's a sense of obligation. I mean, you trouble people for these sorts of stories. It's like you stir their waters around, and then you really give them nothing back. And that sort of hit me the wrong way. I think if it had been written up in your story, I might not have felt that same compulsion. But I really felt compelled then to go and to just tell that story right, and then to tell right what happened in Rafah, which we found out something had happened in the town of Rafah about a week after a large killing in Han Yunus.
And it is an extremely important story in Palestinian history. And maybe you can explicate as to why. I think, it's very important.
Well, I mean, just as a historical episode, if the UN figures are accurate, what happened in Han Yunus is the biggest killing of civilians on Palestinian soil ever. I mean, there were bigger killings in Lebanon in the early 80s at the Sabra Shatila refugee camps. But this was a very large incident, and it was a few people knew about it in Gaza. The older generation seemed to know about it. But what was interesting being there is a lot of younger Palestinians didn't even know about it. And what struck me was this sense that, you know, here you have a people where they have not been able to digest their history. Because as someone told me, and it's in the book, this guy said, history is ongoing. It's sort of, it's continuous. Our story is continuous. It's not like the Battle of Britain that the British people can sort of look back on with some nostalgia and say that's when the few defeated the German Air Force in the air, and now we can make romantic movies about it. If the Battle of Britain was going on to this day, believe me, no one would be going back to 1940 to talk about what a romantic time that was. You know, they've been able to digest their history. Palestinians haven't. And you saw that because the younger people, if they were sort of, some of them were surprised, because as you know, you're talking to them, you're often talking to an old person, and there's a whole crowd with them, often their sons and their grandsons, listening in, and they would say, we've never heard of this. And some of the young people were so concerned about what was going on at the moment. It was like, why are you talking about this old history? Can't you see they're demolishing homes, you know, 200 meters from where we're sitting? I mean, this is my grandfather's story. What about me? What about my son? I even have a scene or two in the book like this. I think it's important because you don't get a sense of a people being pummeled continuously unless you tell those component parts. And this is my attempt to address one thing that simply you don't find anything in a Western language about.
And we interviewed the leader of Hamas, Rantisi,
who
was later assassinated by the Israelis. And he spoke about this. Well, maybe you can tell that.
Right. This is when we were there in 2001. We went to Rantisi's home. As Chris said, one of the leaders of Hamas, and his uncle was lined up.
He was there.
He was a child.
He was a child in Han Yunus.
His uncle was lined up with other men and shot, and killed. And Rantisi said something that really I remember well. He said, "That's when they planted hatred in my heart." And so it gives you a sense of what these sorts of things mean. History isn't. It's very important.
He also said that's when he knew he could never trust the Israelis, ever.
And, yeah, to understand people who've been victimized continually, to understand someone like Rantisi, whose own methods I certainly wouldn't condone, but to understand what's going on with someone like that, you've got to understand the history of the people.
I think that's the importance of empathy, that to understand is not to condone.
Well, what was interesting after 9/11, there was that question that just was sort of ubiquitous. Why do they hate us? Well, I mean, do you want to know or not? Because, you know, maybe maybe there are reasons. Or you might not like their reasons, but there might be reasons. In their minds, anyway, certainly.
Do you see an arc to your work? Do you see yourself moving like Marcel Proust towards something? or
hopefully towards undying fame. well, I probably have talked to you a bit about this, but part of me wants to... I sort of have journalism in my veins. And I mean, as you know, the great privilege of being a journalist, and it really is a privilege, is you get into people's homes. People that you know, because of the fact that you say you're a journalist, they're letting you in and they're telling you their story and they're telling you something you could not get otherwise. It's an enormous privilege, and I never want to lose that feeling of that access to what's going on in people's lives. But there's part of me that I haven't seen anything near what you've seen, because Chris has been all over the place, as you know, seeing really dreadful things. I haven't seen everything, but I've kind of seen enough in a way. And I kind of want to move on, because I'm not sure if it's going to do me any good to keep... I could go to another massacre and do another telling of another massacre. It's possible to do. There are many things that need to be told. But at some point, I began to think, I can explain a lot of the history behind this. I have a hard time explaining certain things. I don't know if you noticed that you saw Goya's picture of the soldiers and you don't see their faces. Now, if you saw my pictures of the Israeli soldiers, you can also see that I didn't draw a lot of their faces. And it wasn't really to dehumanize them. That wasn't my intent. It was when you're drawing someone's eyes, it's important to understand what's going on inside them psychologically. And if I drew their eyes, that was sort of a pretense that I understood what was going on there. And to be honest, the only people's eyes I could draw were sort of sadists, because I can sort of say, imagine this person's a bit off, and I can draw someone's eyes who's like that. But the average ordinary person who's doing that, who's going to go back to his family and live a good life, who's probably a good person, that's something I couldn't get. That's something I can't explain with history. It happens all over the place. The Palestinians do it. The Israelis do it. The Americans do it. You know, everyone engages in this sort of activity. And so now I'm interested in sort of human nature. And I'm interested in things I'd never thought about before, like psychology, neuroscience. You know, what makes us tick? What's going on about the human species? Because I'd like to be able to show those soldiers' faces and sort of understand them.
And what, so far, has your investigation into that topic uncovered?
Ooh, well, I'm just starting out. So to me, it's my absolute lack of knowledge. I've interviewed one guy who wrote a book about, it's called The Most Dangerous Animal, and I interviewed a guy named Phil Zimbardo who ran the Stanford Prison Experiment at Stanford University in the 1970s, where he got some students. He basically randomly, some were chosen as guards, some were as prisoners, and he wanted to see what would happen to the prisoners. What began to interest him in this experiment was what happened to the guards. These normal students, within hours, were abusing these other students in the course of this experiment until after 5 days, the experiment had to be abandoned. And so someone like that can maybe tell me something about what was going on, why people follow orders, or why they fill roles. When you put on a uniform, suddenly you inhabit a new person. You take orders. I mean, all these relationships are interesting to me, this hierarchy that we have as human beings that we seem to need.
And how do you draw that out? How will you illustrate it?
That's the question of questions. I think I'm going to have to draw rather abstractly. Mm. I'm not sure. This is actually, that's the joy of it, that's the creative part of it. Is coming up with ways to draw sort of psychological things or abstract notions.
Do you think you do it as a kind of narrative or not?
This is going to sound strange. I'm doing it disguised as a book about the Rolling Stones. I mean, I've got these other creative ideas. I figure if I use them, I can sort of go off on these very and very serious tangents, but sort of use them to go off. But I also want to be funny. I mean, I miss that about my work. And as a creative person, you know, there are things you might miss about how you used to write or what matters to you. I like it when people can make me laugh. And I used to love doing that. And now I look at my work and I think, okay, it's maybe it's important. People like it. It's grim, though. It's grim to me.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was fun. Thanks a lot. Enjoyed that.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.